is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We might say a few weeks or even months down the line discover there is a new variant behind the deaths, while we still think it is Omicron. COVID-19 evolves so fast, and this is highly unpredictable.
That's a clinical laboratory scientist Thabani Nkubi in Habrone. Details coming up also. Airstrikes kill civilians in Ethiopia's Tigray region. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The UN Human Rights Office says at least 108 civilians have been killed and many more injured in several airstrikes allegedly carried out by the Ethiopian Air Force in the country's northern Tigray region since the start of the new year. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In the past 2 weeks, airstrikes have hit Tigray's state-owned Technical Vocational Education and Training Center, a camp for displaced people, a flour mill, a private minibus, and numerous other civilian targets. UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman Liz Throssell says the number of dead and injured is based on information gathered from different sources by colleagues monitoring the situation in Ethiopia.
The deadliest airstrike so far, which hit the Debit internally displaced persons camp on the 7th of January, left at least 56 people dead and 30 others wounded. We've since established that three of those who were critically injured later died in hospital while receiving medical treatment, pushing the death toll from that single strike to at least 59.
Throssell says monitors continue to receive deeply disturbing reports of civilian casualties and destruction of civilian sites resulting from airstrikes in Tigray.
We call on the Ethiopian authorities and their allies to ensure the protection of civilians and civilian objects, in line with their obligations under international law. Any attack, including airstrikes, should fully respect the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precautions in attack. Failure to respect the principles of distinction and proportionality could amount to war crimes.
The Ethiopian government has not commented on allegations of responsibility for airstrikes in Tigray. The United Nations reports tens of thousands of people have been killed and nearly 2 million displaced since the conflict between pro-Ethiopian government forces and Tigrayan forces erupted in November 2020. It says 5.2 million people are in need of life-saving assistance, with 400,000 living in famine-like conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The head of the Libyan High Council of State, Khalid al-Masri, discussed with the UN Special Advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, avenues towards holding elections as soon as possible. Al-Masri said a constitutional referendum is an ideal way to reach a wide understanding on the voting laws to guarantee fair and transparent elections that would be acceptable to all Libyan parties. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed with Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis, if a constitutional referendum could facilitate the troubled election process.
Unfortunately not. Yes, Khalid al-Misri has a sound intellectual argument that part of the complexity with hosting elections now is that there is no binding constitution. The August 2011 temporary constitutional declaration is no longer in force. However, the reason that he's bringing up this issue of the constitutional referendum is not that it will bring us to a sounder footing on which to hold elections, but rather that sorting out the constitution will just cause other delays that will allow him to stay in his position longer and the higher state council and the House of Representatives to just continue to control the process. So rather than facilitating the troubles elections process, having a referendum will further complicate matters by causing yet another step before having a change of government.
Williams met with the acting Speaker of the House of Representatives to discuss the role of the parliament in launching broad consultations with the internal parties concerned. She said elections should be held before the roadmap to end the transitional period expires in June. What's your take on that?
Well, I completely agree. There should be elections before June. We have so many bodies in Libya which have passed their mandates. Nearly every head of every semi-sovereign institution, the central bank governor, the head of the National Oil Corporation, are all passed their mandates. The Speaker of the House of Representatives has passed his mandate. If we go past June, then this transitional period will expire again, and we'll be in this seventh transitional period, which has expired. Therefore, they should do everything possible to try to host elections by then. However, if no international pressure or threats are brought to bear on the House of the Representatives, then Adila Saleh, the Speaker of that House, will feel no reason to actually create the conditions for the election. And the dynamic here is that the parliament is the body tasked with making the electoral law, but yet the parliament doesn't want there to be elections because it can stay in power so long as there are not elections. And this causes a conflict of interest.
The U.S. Ambassador and Special Envoy to Libya, Richard Norland, said some contradictory candidates led to fears of renewed violence, but that there is still a chance to build on the ceasefire agreement and the political dialogue, which are still in place until now, to bring back elections on the right track. Under what circumstances could the elections be held in Libya?
Well, Ambassador Norland has certainly pointed out the contradictions very accurately, and he's also highlighted the need for the elections. The question is not if he understands the matter. He understands it perfectly well, as does the State Department. The question is, do they have the political capital to work with the UN and with their British and European allies to put pressure on? It's all about the pressure. You can say the right words and you can understand the situation, but that won't do anything until sanctions are brought to bear and pressure is put on to make these recalcitrant status quo actors have incentives to hold the elections. Because incentives were not brought to bear and no threats were used, no binding threats. That's why the elections were delayed, and Adila Saleh and other actors outsmarted the West and the UN, and they called their bluff. Essentially, when there was that meeting in France in November, Macron said, you know, those who are seen as spoilers will suffer consequences. But because those consequences were not articulated, they managed to get away from it, and no one has suffered any consequences. So for me, the circumstances in which elections can be held is when there's a unified international community which has concrete threats about what will happen to anyone who blocks the progress towards elections.
That was Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis, a consulting firm focused on Libya. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. While Botswana's reported COVID-19 cases continue to drop, there has been a sharp increase in deaths. This week, Botswana recorded 17 deaths in a three-day period. From Habrone, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
In December, Botswana health authorities indicated while reported cases were increasing, hospitalizations and deaths due to the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus had remained low. A recent study conducted in California reveals there are 91% fewer deaths from Omicron than the Delta variant. But Botswana is seeing a shift after the country recorded 40 deaths since January 6, the COVID-19 task force reported. In its three-day update released Thursday, the task force says 17 deaths were recorded between Monday and Wednesday, bringing the overall death toll to 2,514. With the rise in the death toll, Botswana's acting director of health services, Kumosi Ipone, says booster shots will be made available to adults.
We've been given the green light by the medicines regulator Bomra to give booster shots. Anyone who has been vaccinated for more than 6 months can get the booster shot.
Scientists say booster shots are at least 80% effective against severe Omicron. In Habroni, clinical laboratory scientist Tabani Ngube says the rise in COVID-19-related deaths could be due to more people catching the highly infectious variant.
It is difficult to tell what could be behind the increase in deaths. Studies have shown that Omicron variant is less aggressive and leads to shorter hospitalization. However, more and more people have been infected with Omicron, and we now need to put these deaths into context and analyze the trends more.
Ngube adds there's a possibility of another variant as the virus continues to evolve.
It is a fast-changing landscape. We might say a few weeks or even months down the line discover there is a new variant behind the deaths, whilst we still think it is Omicron. COVID-19 evolves so fast, and this is highly unpredictable.
Botswana is vaccinated at least 70% of its adult population, while less than 10% of Africa's population overall has received the jab. Last month, the government announced it will start vaccinating children between 12 and 17. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Scores of Rwandans have crossed into the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo in recent days, traveling by small boats to Ijiwi Island in Lake Kivu. Reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti has spoken with some of them and tells VOA's Kate Pondawson what has pushed them to leave home.
Since the beginning of this week, the people from Ijiwi Island in the Kivu Lake reported to people from Rwanda crossing with small boats. Yesterday, we knew about hundreds of people from Rwanda crossing the lake with the boats, fleeing the imposition of the of COVID vaccination. I talked to the administrator of Ijiwi territory, who said he has more than 300 people in different areas of Ijiwi coming from Rwanda. Many of them said they don't want to take COVID vaccination, but the government imposed them to take it.
What are DRC and Rwandan government officials saying? Has there been any official statement?
Not yet. From DRC, there is nothing till now, because they didn't come officially. They didn't use border as they use small boats, so they are not. They don't have a refugee status. But in Rwanda, I talked to the health ministry. She said the Rwandan government didn't impose to someone to take the vaccination. But the problem is the Rwandan government created some rights. For example, someone who is not vaccinated can't use public transportation, can't go in a public meeting, can't get inside a church. So for those people, it's looks that if you are not vaccinated, you don't need to stay in Rwanda because you are not free. That's why they decide to flee from Rwanda.
Have the people who have left, the people who have come over from Rwanda, have they said why they object to the vaccine? Do they have a particular concern?
Some of them say that they have some other sickness, like blood pressure, and they fear about their health if they take a vaccination. What they don't know about it, because corona is a new thing and they don't have any experience on corona vaccination, so they don't want to mix on their sickness another sickness.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma in the DRC. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Pondawson. Rwanda has one of the highest COVID-19 vaccination rates of any African country, with about 60% of all adults vaccinated. The government has imposed policies to encourage vaccinations, including some limits on the activities of those who haven't been vaccinated. IGIHE, an independent Rwandan news site, reports that Rwandan officials have said it is not clear why people have left the country. A government spokesperson told IGIHE that there is no government mandate for people to get COVID-19 vaccinations, although the government is trying to educate people to accept vaccines and to protect the lives of the public. A SpaceX rocket launch Thursday carried three small South African-made satellites that will help with policing South African waters against illegal fishing operations. Produced at the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, the satellite could also be used to help other African countries protect their coastal waters. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
All systems are go for launch. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
SpaceX's billionaire boss Elon Musk has given three nanosatellites produced in his birth country, South Africa, a ride into space. The company's Falcon rocket launched from Cape Canaveral in the U.S. state of Florida with 105 spacecraft on board. All three South African satellites deployed successfully. This mission, known as Transporter 3, is part of SpaceX's rideshare program, which in two previous outings has put over 220 small satellites into orbit. The three South African nanosatellites on this trip were designed at the Cape Peninsula University of Technology's Africa Space Innovation Center. The institution's Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research, Technology and Innovation is Professor David Pahor.
I think it marks a quantum leap in terms of South Africa's capability to participate in the space sector. As you can imagine, the issue of oceans economy has become topical globally, and the fact that we've developed this capacity in South Africa and we're launching these satellites will go a long way in enhancing our capabilities to monitor our coastline and then grow our economy.
Pahor says the university has been building up to the launch of these satellites, known collectively as MDA-SAT-1, with a previous satellite launch in 2018.
These three satellites, there was a precursor to this current three satellite constellation, is ZQ-2, is the most advanced nanosatellite developed on the African continent. And it was launched in December 2018. So these ones are basically part and parcel of that development. And they are probably the most advanced nanosatellites developed on the African continent.
Stephen Cubido studied at the Space Center and graduated in 2014. Today, he works here as a software engineer.
It's been a ride. It's been amazing. Ups and downs, but this is definitely up today. Just to get everything ready for today has been a lot of pressure.
And what has the interaction with SpaceX been like?
It's been complicated, but it's necessary. We are putting objects in space, and space is for everyone. We have to keep it safe for everybody. So we understand the paperwork involved. But yeah, we've got all of the information through to them. And they're launching our satellite, so everything is in order.
The university paid almost $260,000 to secure its spot on the SpaceX craft. It says it hopes to continue the relationship with Elon Musk's company. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
A group of Kenyan LGBT students protested Thursday against the cabinet minister's recent suggestion they be banned from boarding schools. These schools are common in Kenya, and the students and rights groups say a ban would be discriminatory and compromise their safety. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Dozens of angry homosexual students took to the streets of Nairobi Thursday in a peaceful protest to Kenya's Ministry of Education. They were armed with placards that denounced a suggestion by the Cabinet Secretary for Education, George Magoha, that homosexual students be barred from boarding schools. Marylise Bibwa, one of the protesters, said Magoha's comment is beginning to have an effect at some schools.
Because of the directive Magoha has given, I have two students who have already reached out. Mm-hmm. One, I'm planning to start the journey of helping them tomorrow because she was already sent out of school. She has KCSE in March and she can't go back because she was told she's gay.
KCSE is Kenya's Certificate of Secondary School Examination. In their two-page petition to the Education Secretary, the protesters called on him to withdraw his December remarks and to criminalize all types of phobias they say put people's lives at risk, including the lives of homosexual students. Makena Njeri is the founder of Bold Africa, a gay rights network.
Being a gay student going through high school already was a big challenge, constantly being suspended, all the way down to even very close to being expelled. This already is discriminating me as a child when I was in school. Now even the government adding more pressure to institutions to continue discriminating the kids is something that we will not stand.
Kenya is one of many African countries that outlaw homosexuality. VOA has established that the cabinet secretary has yet to officially order boarding schools in Kenya to bar suspected gay students. A state education official speaking on condition of anonymity said ordinarily a formal circular will be sent to all heads of boarding schools.
Implementing such directive is very difficult and would lead to a lot of furor. You can see that the statement made because it came. What about if a principal of a school was seen doing that?
The LGBT community leaders who presented their petition to the Ministry of Education are expected to meet with Magoha next week. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
In yesterday's Cup of Nations match between Ethiopia and Cameroon, Ethiopia caught the Cameroon defense napping and scored its first goal early on. 4 minutes later, Cameroon struck back, scoring the equalizer. Throughout the match, Reuters reports, the Ethiopian team countered valiantly, even if it did not have much possession. But the Ethiopian team wilted after the start of the second half, when Cameroon's captain, Vincent Aboubakar, scored twice in as many minutes, crushing Ethiopia 4-1. Cameroon, which won its opening match with Burkina Faso, now with 6 points, passes to the next stage in the African Cup of Nations tournament. In Group A action, Burkina Faso beat Cape Verde 1-0 yesterday. Today's action includes Senegal taking on Guinea, Malawi facing Zimbabwe, Morocco against Comoros, and Gabon battling Ghana. For all the Africa Cup of Nations Africa, check out VOA's Sunny Side of Sports on voanews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And look for the Sunny Side of Sports on Twitter and Facebook. In male-dominated societies like Burkina Faso, wives are most often blamed when marriages run into trouble. But a project funded by the World Bank is testing the concept of teaching men how to be better husbands by taking them to school. Henry Wilkins reports from Yako, Burkina Faso.
The path to a successful marriage is not always an easy one, but an initiative set up in Burkina Faso by the Sahel Women's Empowerment and Demographic Dividend, SWED, aims to make it less difficult. Yeli Owigo, who is married to Kwame Zupoka, attended so-called husband schools organized by SWED to help him become a better spouse. Before taking part in the classes, life as a couple wasn't easy, says Owigo. He says he once didn't think that women and men had much in common when it comes to problems with family life. But after the classes, he understood they can complement and help each other. Burkina Faso is a male-dominated society, but the schools use a variety of teaching techniques, including role plays, to help the men understand the needs of their wives and how to meet them, for example, helping with housework. They also teach the men about women's rights, family planning, health and hygiene, and the men are encouraged to include women in making family decisions too. The coordinator of the project in this area of Burkina Faso, Nabalu Bibata, says the classes have made a big difference to women in the community. She says there are even men who have attended the childbirth of their wives, which is part of assuming responsibility for the care of the children by the men. She says for the men of the village who weren't able to participate in the husband schools, those who did have become role models. Although these are the first schools of their kind in Burkina Faso, similar projects have already been implemented in countries like South Africa and Niger. Edward Wageni is global head for the UN Women He for She initiative. He says the school can help reduce incidents of domestic violence, and they are also about
the acknowledgement that gender equality is not just about women and girls. Gender equality is about everybody,
including men and boys. Asked if husband schools could be beneficial in countries outside Africa, where statistically gender equality is better than Burkina Faso, Wageni replied,
"So this is a good idea that can be replicated and even scaled up in other parts of the world, including those countries that feel that they have made a lot of gains."
Zupoka, meanwhile, says the classes have made her husband much more helpful and considerate. She says the love between her and her husband is growing. Now, when my husband goes to the market, he brings me little gifts, something he didn't do before, she says. So, she says, she is very, very satisfied. The national coordinator of the Husband Schools project says it's been a resounding success and is going to be expanded to other parts of the country. The second phase of the project is due to start later this year. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Yako, Burkina Faso.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website.